The best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York, has expanded. Leaders say new lab space will make the facility a national leader in cancer research. And we'll learn about a giant centipede with a talent for toxins. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Buffalo, New York's Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center has opened the largest academic good manufacturing, engineering, and cell manufacturing facility in the U.S. Officials say an 11,000-square-foot expansion adds lab space to deliver life-saving cancer treatments. To learn more about the facility and what it means for cancer research, I spoke with Roswell Park Department of Medicine Chair, Dr. Rainier Brentjens.
So I got to Roswell Park about 3 years ago. And when I got there, we had six GMP rooms. And so a GMP room is a very highly specialized laboratory space that allows for investigators to make cell products that can be safely given to patients. And so we had six rooms 3 years ago, and we just finished building an additional 14 rooms so that we have now a 20-room GMP facility, which makes it the largest GMP facility of any academic institution in the country.
What will this added capacity be able to help facilitate in terms of research? How will that be an advantage to the existing facility?
Well, so it gives us far greater capacity. When you have 20 rooms, 20 rooms are not always open and functional. In fact, many of those rooms require maintenance, and you can only make so many products in each individual room. So what it does is it gives the institution the capacity to run more clinical trials rather than what we would be able to do in a six-room facility. And what this means is that it allows investigators at Roswell Park to develop and test these new cell therapies preclinically, so in petri dishes and in mice, but then gives a way for us to translate that work and see if it is of benefit to our patients. And so our capacity to do that and the number of different trials for different cancers that we can run is now markedly expanded. In addition, we don't anticipate that we would need all those rooms for work that's being done by our investigators at the center, but it also allows us to collaborate with smaller biotechnology companies that may have promising cell therapies and just don't have a venue for being able to translate this to the clinical setting as well. And so biotech can approach us and propose and demonstrate or show to us what technology they have and what approaches they want to use. And if we, as investigators in the field, feel that this would have promise for our patients, we can actually take their technology and translate it to the clinical setting. And so we not only will be able to move our own research forward to clinical trials, but we can also be of assistance and collaborators with biotechnology companies and allow them the opportunity, which is obviously the goal for any company as such, to test and assess the function of their technology against cancers in patients.
I hadn't realized that there was sort of a biotech bottleneck, if you will. So lab space, is this something that is needed in the field of cancer research sort of overall?
Yeah, well, yes, on multiple levels. Bigger biotech companies can build their own facilities, obviously. But smaller biotech companies will have to work through other companies to generate plasmid, to generate the viruses which are used to transfer the genes into the cells, and then find yet another company that can actually make the cells. And even then, so they've made the cells, they have to find an academic institution that is comfortable with cell therapy technology and safety to run the trials. And in our setting, we can not only provide all of those services, including the actual clinical trial and investigators that can run those clinical trials and patients that could potentially benefit from those trials. But we can probably also do it at a significantly lower cost than having to go through all these different outside companies. And so we can do it in a much more expedient fashion. We can provide the clinical expertise to run these trials, and we can do it at a much lower rate than would be if they went through all these outside companies. So it's faster, it's cheaper, and it's safer because we have the expertise to apply these novel therapies in first-in-human studies.
And Dr. Brentjens, do you have any examples of any particular studies or therapies that are currently under research that, as an example, would be able to be more fully developed or researched at the new center?
So I can speak to the clinical the programs that we're developing in our laboratories. We have a cadre of investigators that work on cell therapies at Roswell Park, including my own lab. And what we're looking at right now is to try to develop these types of cell therapies. We call them CAR T cells, which stands as an acronym for chimeric antigen receptor T cells, which are basically immune cells that we take from the patient, and then we genetically engineer these immune cells to recognize the tumor cells, and then we grow them up in that GMP facility, expand them, and then infuse them back into the patient with the idea that these immune cells will find the tumor and start attacking the tumor, which ordinarily doesn't occur when a patient has cancer, obviously. And, you know, me personally, I've been working on this technology for 25 years. Doesn't seem that long, but the numbers don't lie. And we started out, because I'm a leukemia doctor, we started out targeting different types of leukemias. And those efforts have resulted in multiple FDA-approved products that patients can now get commercially if you have different types of leukemias or lymphomas. But the question, because the first one of these drugs was approved back in 2017, I think, by the FDA. But to date, this technology really has had application primarily to blood cancers. And far more common cancers are solid tumor cancers, such as colon cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, and so on. And there's still a lot of research that needs to be done in the laboratory to find ways of making this approach work in these solid tumors. And so some of the projects that are set to be applied to this new facility are programs where we generate these types of cells for patients with, say, sarcomas, with ovarian cancer, with different types of lung cancer, et cetera. So when we talk about what types of these cell therapies are being studied in clinical trials, well, next generation CAR T cells designed to do better than the first generation in blood cancers is an example of research that has a great deal of interest and I guess popularity, if you wish, at our center and at other academic centers, and obviously through different biotechnology companies. But more significantly, really, is trying to cross this chasm between blood cancers and solid tumor cancers. And I think that there's a great deal of interest, both academically as well as in the industry, to be able to translate this technology that works quite well in blood cancers to the more common solid tumor cancers.
In this research, does Roswell Park coordinate with local universities? What are the opportunities for student learning in this research?
Well, so that's on multiple levels. So I think many of the labs at Roswell Park have summer internships for college students, even high school students we've had in the lab. And because the university obviously has graduate students, we actually have a significant amount of interest because of the novelty of this technology. There's a significant number of graduate students that are interested in coming into a lab that works on this type of technology. Now, those graduate students are the ones that really develop the next generation of these CAR T cells. But generally, the graduate students focus on the science and focus on the preclinical development. When it comes time to translate that to the clinical setting, we have obviously faculty that run the clinical trials, but we also have fellows, which are physicians studying to specialize in oncology, who get involved with the development of those and the running of those clinical trials as well. In addition, a lot of the local universities and colleges in Western New York, they have a lot of technicians or those studying to be laboratory technicians, which provides us with a workforce that will actually do all the things and run the GMP facility. So you can't run a 20-room facility without staff, and we're very fortunate in Western New York that there are a number of places that have programs that train people that can be then further educated to work in such a GMP facility. So we're very dependent on that as well.
And just building off of that, what do you think this investment will mean for the Western New York region with either attracting biotechnology companies or other ways of economic development?
Well, so I think that's a great question. I think, was it last year, Zillow said that Buffalo had the number one real estate market, and I'm not a realtor, but with all those colleges there, I personally, and I think that's shared by others, think that Buffalo is ripe to become a biotech hub. There's a lot that goes into it that's well beyond my expertise, obviously, into making that happen. But the best way to start demonstrating what the potential is of Western New York in the context of the biotech industry is to successfully open up an academic GMP facility like we did, and demonstrating success there. In addition, the goal always has been, obviously, first and foremost, is to provide the best cancer care, the newest cancer care for the patients in Western New York. But we do look beyond our borders. We look at the state of New York and the country itself. And in fact, the phrase that we kind of coined when I got to Roswell is that we want to become a global destination site for cell therapy. And if we do that successfully, which I fully believe we can, which is patients come from all over because we're going to have unique trials that may not be available anywhere else in the world, that will too spur interest, I think, from the biotech field as well as the field of cell therapy in general, and draw attention to Roswell Park as being a leader in this type of technology.
Dr. Renier Brentjens is an oncologist and Department of Medicine chair at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The venom of a species of centipede found in Australia can be tailored to deliver a painful sting depending on the situation. Dr. Vanessa Schendel, a venom biologist at the University of Queensland, says the arthropod's pincers can deliver a custom mix of toxins. To learn more, The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Dr. Schendel.
So the red-headed centipede, the Scolopendra morsitans, is one of the giant centipedes, so to say. It's actually kind of, well, if you can say pretty. You can find it here in Australia. in the desert. So I live in Brisbane, so here we can't find that species. So we'd have to go out further inland into the desert, and that's where you can find it.
When it comes to the giant red-headed centipede, they have sharp pincers near their mouth, and I just want to know what sort of toxins they release.
Yeah, so the pincers you said, so we call them forcipules. As you said, they're close to the mouth, but they're actually not part of the mouth parts. They are actually modified legs. So that's why we also would technically not say that centipedes bite, but they would sting because they're not really part of the mouth. So that they're not like teeth or anything. The species that I was interested in, the red-headed centipede, they have a very complex venom, and they're when we get stung by them, it's also very, very painful. So they do have lots of pain-causing toxins, but they also use their venom to paralyze prey. And centipedes, especially the scolopendra moths, so the red-headed centipedes that I was looking at, they have a very complex venom. So they have probably around 100 different toxins, but there are a lot of toxins where we don't even know what they actually do.
Wow. And how did you collect the venom for the study that you did about this species? And what did you find out about the toxins that the centipede releases?
Often, for venomous animals, for example, also for spiders, people collect the venom using electrostimulation. So you apply a little electric current, and the idea behind it is that that will lead the surrounding muscle tissues, the muscles around the venom gland, to contract and then push out the venom. And that's what people have done for centipedes as well. People who have studied their venom before, they use electrostimulation to collect the venom. And that's what I did too. I was also interested in whether centipedes can somehow, because they've got so many different venom components and they use it for different purposes, for example, for predation and defense. And I wanted to know if they can somehow control which venom components, which toxins they use in a certain situation, or if they always secrete everything. And so I used the electrostimulation, thinking that way everything should get secreted, so all the toxins that there are. And then I wanted to compare it to a different approach, where I just grab the centipede behind the head and then make it sting into a tube which is covered with a little parafilm, like it's like a little membrane. So similar to what you see for how people milk snakes. So you just grab it and then make it sting into something. And so I did that, and I then analyzed the venom from those two different methods. So the using electrostimulation, when we thought we would get all the toxins, and then grabbing it behind the head. So that's more like a defensive situation. So we thought maybe in that case the centipede would only secrete defensive toxins. And then we compared these two and found that it's absolutely not what we thought. So first of all, we don't get all the venom components when we use electrostimulation. So we were kind of confused about what's going on there, but then yeah, did some more analysis and later on figured out why that was the case. And that's because the venom secretion mechanism is a lot more complicated, and it's not just muscle tissue around the venom gland that contracts and the venom gets or the toxins get squeezed out. But it seems to be the case that a second stimulus is needed to get all the venom components. For that, hormones and neurotransmitter would be involved to also release some of the venom components.
And now we know that the centipede releases different toxins under different stimulations, like attacking prey or under defense, like they're under threat. So I just want to know, if you know, what the differences between the toxins that the centipede releases, depending on if it's being attacked or if it is attacking prey, is there a difference in the response of that creature that the toxins is going into, depending on the venom that it
Oh,
excretes?
I see. So you mean if we, for example, collect different, so the predatory toxins or the defensive toxins, and then inject it into a spider or something, if something didn't happen. Well, we have not tried that, but I assume that that's the case. What we did test was we tested the different venom collection, venom harvesting methods. So we, for the electrostimulated venom and the defensive venom, and there we found that only the defensive venom, so the venom that we collected using the technique where we actually grabbed the centipede, only that one was active in a pain assay. So we tested it on cells, and only for the defensive toxin we got a response, and that only showed us more that with the electrostimulation we do not get all the venom components. Or it could also be the case that the toxins have to get activated, so that we only got inactive toxins using the electrostimulation. But we have not injected predatory venom versus defensive venom and injected it into animals. But yeah, I would assume that we see differences there, and that the predatory venom would be paralyzing towards their typical prey, and that the defensive venom would probably be pain-causing.
I'm curious about this. Why would you think that something like the red-headed centipede release different toxins depending on the different situation? And do you have a reason as to why maybe they do that?
Yeah, so there have been lots of studies in general about venoms, and venom metering is sometimes what they call. So it has been observed in lots of different animals that they, for example, when they bite or sting, that they don't use all of their venom if it's not necessary, for example. And yeah, for some other animals, it has been shown that they kind of can control which toxin components they use. So it's not just the case for centipedes. It has been shown for other species as well. And some people said that it's probably because it is very costly to produce the toxins. So it takes up energy for the animal to produce these toxins. But others say that they kind of tried to test that and didn't see that it is that costly, that it does need that much energy from the animal. But then also other people have shown that, well, depending on the animal and depending on the toxins, it can take days, for up to weeks, I think, for some toxins to regenerate. So if you use all your venom, then it can take days or maybe even weeks for all the venom components to regenerate. And within that period of time, you don't have all of those components available. And then obviously the animal would be more vulnerable to attack, or maybe it wouldn't be able to use the venom to catch prey.
Kind of piggybacking off your answer there, you said the species, any species that has venom produces it. How do they produce their venom?
So it's very, very different. So in general, venoms are extremely diverse. Venoms have evolved more than 100 times independently in very, very different animal lineages. And when you think, so most people probably, when they hear venom, they think of snakes and spiders. And for example, both of them have fangs, or they use mouth parts to inject their venom. And usually there are venom glands inside those venom apparatuses, we would call them, and these tissues, glands, produce the venom. But then, for example, if we think of bees, they have stingers, so they have evolved very differently, and they are venom glands that produce the venom in all these different animal lineages are also very different. And we actually don't know that much about venom glands and how venom is produced and stored and secreted. So most people are only interested in the venom itself, the toxins themselves, and want to kind of use them as tools, for example, to develop new drugs. But there's a huge gap of knowledge when it comes to how venom is actually produced and secreted and all of that. And our study, for example, shows that so a lot of people use electrostimulation also in other animals, in spiders, for example, to collect the venom. And no one knew that maybe you don't even get all the venom components. So as you can see, there's a huge gap. No one knew that might be the case, that the venom secretion mechanism, for example, is not as we thought, because no one's really looked into that.
And with this study, do you believe that there are other animals that use their toxins and their venom in the same way as this centipede has showcased?
Yeah, I think so. So the reason why we did our study was because other people have shown for corn snails and assassin bugs that they can control which toxins they use in a certain situation. And I think once you look more closely and analyze that for more animals, you'll see that other animals will probably also be able to do that. Yeah.
And does this finding excite you as a venom biologist? And if so, why?
Yeah, it does, because it's something new, something that you maybe wouldn't expect. Yeah, it's also, as you said, like, why would they do that? There are still a lot of questions still behind it that we haven't really answered. And there's yeah, knowing that it's a lot more complex than we thought, that kind of opens for me as a biologist more doors. Like, maybe I want to explore in other directions there and look more closely into that and see what else is going on and what other things there might be that we don't know about.
And I was just going to ask, how will you continue to study this in the future? And what do you hope to uncover, or maybe other scientists and biologists uncover about this centipede and other species when it comes to releasing venom and the different toxins that they use?
Yeah, so I think for us it was a huge thing to actually understand how centipedes secrete venom, so how the whole venom secretion mechanism and how it's more complex. And so that there's muscle tissue around the venom glands and venom secretion is under neuromuscular control. So the muscle contraction will squeeze out all the venom. That's not a new idea, so that's yeah, nothing really new, but we show that there are probably neurotransmitters and hormones involved as well. So my idea would be that in a different situation, like for example, if you're hungry, or if the centipede is hungry or scared, if you can even say that, scared, like, but in different situations, I would assume that different neurotransmitters and different hormones are released, and then depending on that, which neurotransmitters and hormones are around, the different toxins would be released depending on those neurotransmitters and hormones.
That's Dr. Vanessa Schendel, a venom biologist at the University of Queensland in Australia, speaking with the best of our knowledges, Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1786. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.